This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Okay, folks, I think it's time to get going again. Second reader for tonight is going to be Lou Morgan. Lou's first novel came out from Solaris as Blood and Feathers, and that came out in 2012 and was nominated for Best Debut and Best Fantasy Novel in the British Fantasy Awards for 2013. The sequel, Blood and Feathers Rebellion, was out last year. And Lou has also had short stories in anthologies by PS Publishing, Solaris, and a company called Jurassic. And I believe that's a story that Lou's going to read us today, which is something about her mummy.
Hello, I had terrible, terrible microphone juju. So is that okay? Last time I read this, I did actually kill the microphone, so I'm kind of hoping that doesn't happen now.
If you can kill that woman, then that's great, because we can get a good one.
Don't break it. This story appears in an anthology called The Book of the Dead from Jurassic Press, and they're a really interesting press that go after really a really wide range of authors. This particular one, as the name implies, is all about Egyptian mummies, and it has contributors like Paul Cornell and Molly Tanzer and Adam Roberts and Will Hill, and it's a really fun anthology, and my story in it is called Her Heartbeat, an Echo. She arrived on a Tuesday morning, the grey drizzly weather doing nothing to deter the crowds or the photographers gathered around the entrance and hoping to catch a glimpse of her, however brief. From a small square window on the fifth floor of the Sutherland Wing, a security guard looked down on the little circus and unclipped a walkie-talkie from his belt. Mike? It's Russ. I know. I see it. Send someone out to help the boys, would you? He paused, watching the lorry as it reversed into the museum's loading dock. For Christ's sake, make sure they don't drop this one. Dave Blewett had been with the museum for 11 years, many of which had been spent ambling through the halls and corridors on his rounds late at night with no particular care, and had never seen anything like the pandemonium of the loading bay as the lift truck backed away from the lorry with a large packing crate balanced on its forks. There were people everywhere, making the already nerve-wracking unloading process even more chaotic. Curators and keepers, docents, students, security staff, even one man who Dave had never seen beyond the walls of a card catalogue room. All of them were there, just like the crowds outside, waiting for their first look at the princess. Dave couldn't pronounce her name. He'd read it on the bulletin board in the security office, written in neat uppercase letters on the weekly activity sheet. It had a lot of eyes in it. Whatever her name was, she was the jewel of the exhibition, the largest the museum had hosted in a decade. Already she'd caused a sensation in France and riots in Germany, where the demand for tickets to see her had far outstripped supply, even after the museum's exhausted director announced they would remain open 24 hours a day for a month in an attempt to keep up with the crowds. When they had released the first pre-sale tickets to the exhibition, The Life and Death of a Princess, the traffic had crashed the museum's servers so definitively that it took 14 hours to get them back up and running again. Dave didn't think he'd seen the IT department get through so many cigarettes or so much coffee in one day before, and that was saying something. The forklift reversed past him, followed by the crowds of keepers from the ancient Egyptian department, and he watched as the crate disappeared into the gloom. He didn't see what all the fuss was about, really. It looked like every other crate that came through the loading bay, strapped and stapled and stamped with customs pre-cleared in big red letters, and as always, accompanied by a buzzing little entourage of archaeologists. There was a rattle from somewhere in the bowels of the building as the door to the cargo lift slammed shut. Princess or not, she was still coming in through the service entrance. The Petrie room had been closed for several weeks ahead of the princess's arrival while the exhibition team prepared. Boards were wheeled in, wires taped down, and ramps locked into place. glass cases and black painted plinths, each carefully arranged and labelled, were rolled into position and hooked up to lighting and climate control systems, to alarms and motion sensors and 1,000 other devices. They sat, elegantly lit and empty, waiting for her. The royal procession went on for hours, long after the crowds at the gate had gone, long after the museum had closed for the night and the last curious visitors had been ushered past the petri stores as crate after crate was wheeled inside. The civilized chaos continued well into the early hours, and the sound of electric screwdrivers and hammers echoed around the deserted halls with only the statues to hear them. The exhibition would not open to the public for some days, not until labels had been checked and rechecked. Not until the VIPs had been given their private tours, the donors and the board and the handful of politicians who had pulled strings at their departments, escorted in hushed solemnity from case to case, while champagne fizzed in glasses on silver trays, leafing through exhibition catalogues with all the princess's otherworldly goods laid out in tableau. Her life dissected and made fit for display. Her death, too. Her afterlife, her hair combs and bangles, her cups and her game boards. Her shoes, her pets, and her gods. Her heart, neat in its cat-headed jar. A rare find, according to the tag, for by the time she lived and died, the fashion was to leave the heart intact and where it had lain in life. A just reward for a job well done. But the princess was a princess, in death no less than in life. More so, it seemed, for even a royal household could not have sustained so many keepers and curators as were crowded around the glass coffin where she lay in state, awaiting her public from 7 o'clock the next morning. That night, that quiet night, when the work was done and the last of the VIPs had downed the last of the champagne and accepted their complimentary postcard packs, when the museum was silent and still, Dave found himself on the rotor to cover the graveyard shift in the Petri room. It wasn't often that the Petri had its own guard. After all, for 9 months of the year, it was a largely empty space, used for lectures or workshops or, to the joy of all the staff, a lunchroom for school visits. That night, however, as Dave plodded along the empty corridors, was different. It would be his own private view of the exhibition, an audience, he thought, with Her Royally Departed Highness. He let himself into the Petri quietly, turning off the usual motion detectors as he went. The director had been getting greyer and greyer as the week had gone on, and Dave didn't think he would thank him for a midnight wake-up call. Not tonight. Not any night, come to think of it. His feet made no sound as they sank into the thick grey carpet specially laid for the exhibition. Everything was muffled and hushed, and it felt like being in church as he pottered about between the displays, picking his way through the unfamiliar layout. There would be plenty of time to get to know it properly, thought Dave. She'd be there for 3 months, and with Mike off on holiday soon and Ricky still on paternity leave, he and the princess would get more than their fair share of late nights together. He stopped beside one case, looking in at a bowl inlaid with what was once coloured glass. Or maybe it was enamel. He didn't read the label. Beside it, on the velvet-covered shelf, there was a scrap of cloth. "Papyrus," he said, and the sound of his voice startled him as he read the tag aloud. On the shelf below, a collection of beads, wooden and clay, lay strung together on a golden wire. "Nice enough, if you like that sort of thing." The cases were laid out in a loose spiral, forming a labyrinth with her at the centre. Raised on a dais, she lay in a gilded sarcophagus, the decorated lid lifted up and away, propped at an angle within the case to raise her head. At her feet, the canopic jars sat in a row, the heart in the middle, the carved animal stoppers watching him as he stepped onto the platform. Dave leaned as close to the glass as he dared, peering down through it at the sarcophagus. His breath misted on the surface. "So you're what all the fuss is about, are you?" Her golden mask stared back at him impassively. Below it, he could see the edges of the linen strips which bound her, and it struck him as strange that the hand which had wound them had taken such care and pain. It was long dead itself, and little more than dust by now. "Makes you think, doesn't it?" he asked the woman. "Makes you feel small." He turned his attention back to her mask, gazing at it. It was beautifully made, there was no denying it, and as fine after all these years as it must have been the day it was made. What kind of woman, he thought, could command such love, such attention, such devotion, even in death? But for all the love and devotion, she was still alone, wasn't she? Alone and trapped in a tomb made of glass. Before he quite knew what he was doing, Dave found himself patting the top of the case. Don't you feel lonely, love? I'm here. Embarrassed, he stopped. Best be off. He tapped a finger thoughtfully on his watch. Big day for you tomorrow. You'll be needing your beauty sleep. He stepped down from the dais and, pushing his hands into his pockets, began to work his way back through the maze of her possessions to the door, arming the alarm once more as he passed it. The sound of his whistle, an off-key attempt at an aria he'd heard in an advert, echoed through the museum. In the stillness of the petri room, the princess slept. But as Dave's whistle faded into the night, a new sound took its place. A faint, muffled thump, almost too quiet to be heard at all. Thump. And then it came again. Thump. Thump, thump. Thump, thump. Thump, thump. It was coming from the cat-headed jar at the feet of the princess. Dave had never found it easy to get to sleep after a night shift, and that day was no exception. Barely 3 hours after he had gone to bed, he gave up chasing the darkness and dragged himself out of his bedroom to the sofa. The lunchtime television news was covering the official opening of the exhibition, and there was the director on the front steps of the museum, the Egyptian department's head keeper beside him. They were framed against the queues snaking through the Grand Plaza, out of the gates and down the street. They fumbled for the remote control and turned it out. They were talking about the importance of museums, of government funding, of the exhibition, of the artifacts on display, the same things the director always talked about in interviews in the vain hope that the more he talked, the less chance there was of their funding being cut. It hadn't made a difference so far, but that didn't usually stop him. The picture cut abruptly to the crowds inside, panning across the backs of heads and shoulders to settle on a vase, the sole of a sandal, a scroll, and finally, on her, on the princess herself. Artifact. Dave turned the word over in his mind. Was that all she was? A show? Was that what she had become? Whoever had wrapped her, tightened those bandages, set the mask over her face. They hadn't thought that, had they? It didn't seem right somehow to make her the same as the coins and the broken pots and old arrowheads dug up in some muddy field, which now filled gallery after gallery in the museum. She wasn't the same, not the same at all. She'd been a person, hadn't she? She had a name. Even if he couldn't quite remember what that name was. Struck by a pang of sudden guilt, Dave wrapped his old grey bathrobe more tightly around himself and shuffled over to the kitchen, switching on the kettle. As he waited for it to boil, he picked up the copy of the exhibition catalogue he'd found in the security office at the end of his shift. He flicked through it, listening to the water bubbling and the newsreaders moving on to a heartwarming story about a three-legged dog who rode the escalators at Bank Station. The catalogue was full of artful close-ups of bits of old wood, strips of old cloth, and paintings of men with funny-looking beards, rows of them with their hands raised and all of them wearing what looked like white dresses. Turning further pages showed him torn scraps of papyrus and what looked like a rat wrapped in bandages, but which, on closer examination of the notes printed alongside it, turned out to be a mummified cat. Funny bunch, them Egyptians, said Dave as he poured the milk and the water into his mug and dropped a teabag in after them. Sitting down at the table, he carried on flipping. He turned one more page and froze, the cup halfway to his lips. There she was. It was not a photograph. Rather, it was an artist's impression of how she might have looked, put together no doubt by the archaeological art department who lived in the museum's basement and seemed to get through almost as much coffee as the IT department. She had long, dark hair, braided and oiled and swept back from her face. A soft face and a wide mouth. Dark ringed eyes which stared defiantly out from the page, meeting his gaze and holding it. And he set down the mug with a shaking hand, his tea forgotten. How young she looked. How young and how sad. And just as he had thought before, how alone. He leaned back in his chair. Alone. She'd been by herself for so long, hadn't she? All the keepers in the world couldn't change that, alone in a tomb in the dark and the cold. And now, alone in a sea of people, who thought of her as nothing more than another artifact. Something to tick off in their guidebooks, something to look at with the same respectful indifference they would show in antique bones. What was her name again? By the time Dave clocked in for his shift that evening, he'd read the entire catalogue, twice. Sitting at his kitchen table, still in his threadbare robe and slippers, he had scoured the pages looking for everything, something, anything that would help him to understand her. He had read about heart scarabs, about the field of reeds and the books of the dead. He had read about spells to open mouths, to change form, or to drive away crocodiles. He had learned about the princess, about her life and her death, just as the exhibition title promised, and the gods who watched over her. And as he buttoned his collar, he felt that he knew her, at least a little better than before. Just after midnight, he let himself into the Petrie room once again, switching off the alarm as he had done the previous night. This time, however, he did not follow the labyrinthine path through the displays. Instead, he cut straight to the centre, to her. There she was, just as he had left her, the golden mask still resting across her face, a face that he now knew to be warm and soft and full of life, or had been once. He wondered what her voice would be like if she spoke to him, high and soft, girlish, or confident and commanding. The catalogue couldn't tell him that. "Hope you don't mind," he said to the quiet of the room. "I brought my tea." He held up the carrier bag containing a thermos flask and a sandwich wrapped in clingfilm. "Thought it might be nice to have a bite to eat together, Isabel. I've been reading about you." He whispered the last words as though someone might hear. Unwrapping his sandwich, he tore it in half and set one piece down on the carpet beside the glass case. "Prawn, I hope you like it. It's just, I didn't have a lot in. The book said you ate a lot of fish, so..." He tailed off, embarrassed, and poured a little tea into the lid of the thermos, putting it next to his little offering and chewing thoughtfully. "Well, this is nice," he said. The princess did not reply. His sandwich finished, Dave dusted the crumbs from his hands. He stopped. What should he do with the tea and the sandwich he'd offered her? Should he clear it up, or should he leave it? It wasn't like she was really going to eat it, was she? But on the other hand, was it some kind of insult if he took it away? He resolved to consult the catalogue as soon as his shift was finished. The book would tell him what to do. In the meantime, he decided to err on the side of practicality, and he collected up the sandwich as best he could. "My boss, you know," he said by way of apology, gathering up his thermos in the carrier bag. "Well, I'll come by again later." He scrunched the bag into his fist and tucked the thermos under his arm. And he was just about to reactivate the alarm when he heard something. Thump, 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 thump. Dave frowned, listening. Whatever it was coming from inside the room, and it most certainly not been there the night before. He listened a moment longer, then unclipped the radio from his belt and pressed a yellow button on the side of it. "Charlie, make a note to get maintenance over to the Petrie when they get in, would you? The air con's on the blink again." He keyed in the code for the alarm and closed the door behind him. The days and nights passed. The former, Dave spent either at home, reading and rereading the exhibition catalogue until its pages were loose and dog-eared, or, much to the amusement of his colleagues in the Egyptian department, where the librarian had taken a bemused but supportive interest in his sudden enthusiasm, and had set aside a pile of books for him to read. The nights he increasingly spent in the Petrie room, hurrying the rest of his rounds so that he could sit beside her. Sometimes he would take the newspaper, reading aloud the stories he thought she might like. Sometimes he took a book from the archives, reasoning that it hadn't left the building, and read her pages from that, although then he worried that it might make her homesick, so he stopped. Occasionally, they did the crossword as he sat on the carpet beside her. He found the cryptic a bit of a struggle, but she seemed to prefer it, so he soldiered on. The noise was still there, that quiet, insistent thudding sound he had heard weeks before. And although maintenance had checked the fans, the ducts and the vents for the air conditioning system as far away as the third floor, they could find no fault with it. But yes, they admitted there was a noise, and it was definitely coming from something in the Petri room. As soon as the exhibition left and the space was broken down again, they would put in for a work order to take the floor up. Hopefully, that would solve the problem. This conversation had upset Dave. It had upset him so much that he had excused himself, hurrying along the corridors and up the grand staircase to the second floor, where, watched over by the martyrdom of Thomas a Becket, he had sat on a bench and rocked back and forth, sobbing into his palm. Until that moment, it hadn't occurred to him that one day soon, the exhibition would leave. But she would leave. He knew she didn't want to go. He could feel it. After all the time they had spent together, he knew what she wanted better than anyone else, better even than she did. He had tried so hard to understand her, to be the kind of man she deserved. He had taken to oiling his hair, like the book said, to anointing himself with cedar and juniper oils, bought specially from a shop in Covent Garden and wrapped by the smiling assistant in tissue paper the colour of an Egyptian sky. He had assumed they were a gift for a relative, a colleague, a friend, and David let him. The oil had given him a rash, which burned beneath his skin, which was starting to run to sores, but she didn't need to know that. All she need know was that he loved her. She was a princess. Love was what she deserved. On the final day of the exhibition, he dragged himself to the museum several hours before her shift began. He didn't want to miss a moment with her, didn't want to arrive and find her boxed and labelled and ready to be stolen away from him. Besides, his sleep had been no better. He dreamt of sitting in a large room with a high ceiling and grey painted wood panelling on the walls. There were tables arranged in rows, laid for a meal, and tall glass doors opening onto a terrace. Beyond lay a vast glass pyramid, its sides glinting in the sunlight. She stood on the balcony, her back to him, silhouetted against the shining glass. "It's a dream," she had said, and her voice was just as he had come to imagine it. "How do you know?" he'd asked, knowing all the while that she was right. "This is the Louvre, not your museum at all." She pointed to the pyramid ahead of her, and there was a rustle of fabric, paper dry. "I liked it here, but the river, it carries me always on, and I am weary." There was a sadness in her voice that made his throat tighten. "The Louvre." He stumbled over the unfamiliar word. "That's the French one, isn't it?" Something nagged at the back of his sleeping mind. "How can I be dreaming it? I've not been there. But I am." And as she spoke, she turned to face him, and he saw a sudden flash of her face in the light. Blackened with age, her soft lips shriveled and parched and peeling away from where her teeth should have been. Her skin was cracked and harder than bone, and there were dark hollows where once there had been warm cheeks. Empty eye sockets met his gaze and held it. He woke with a scream, his bedsheets clammy and stuck to his skin. It was only a dream, his or hers. The last of the visitors had gone. The staff were, one by one, filtering into the Petri room for the director's traditional speech. At the end of every visiting exhibition, he would thank them, as though there wasn't still a museum to run, paperwork to be done, artifacts to be stored or retrieved or cleaned. Dave hung back, his eyes locked onto the glass case on the dais. There was a polite round of applause as the director finished speaking. Dave stood in the shadows beside the display board, dwarfed by the larger-than-life photo of the princess's golden mask. He waited, listening to the sound of trolleys being wheeled down the hallway. They were coming. They were coming to take her. They were coming to take her, and she didn't want to go. He knew her. He knew she didn't want to go. She wanted to stay here, to stay with him. She loved him. He couldn't say it. She couldn't say it. But she loved him. He could feel it. She loved him, and he loved her. With a burst of speed that would have surprised anyone who knew him, he rushed towards the dais, throwing himself at the wooden platform as the doors swung open. There was the sound of laughter, then of someone calling his name. There was a hand on his shoulder, and there was a shout. Footsteps somewhere behind him. So many footsteps muffled by the thick, soft carpet, but then only the thump, the thump, the thump, the thump of a heartbeat filling his ears as the world went black. In the galleries of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, two curators stood in front of a newly installed exhibit. One of them was sweating slightly, the other pulling on a pair of conservation gloves. "I swear it wasn't like that when we set it up," said the sweatier of the two, running a hand back through his hair. His companion simply frowned and dropped into a crouch alongside the case, peering through the glass to get a better look. "Better start praying it's London's fault and not ours, then. Open it up." The princess lay in the stillness of her climate-controlled coffin, and just as she had in London, in Paris and Berlin, in Cairo and in Rome. But what no one could explain was how, despite the care, despite the precautions and the expertise of all involved, the cat-headed canopic jar containing her heart had cracked clean across in the night, spilling grey dust onto the black velvet of its peak.
Thank you very much, Lou. We'll take another short break now, and then we'll come back and have some questions and answers with our two readers.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.